Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Metastatic Prostate Cancer. Now, this is part two of a three-part series of Living with Prostate Cancer. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 833 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions and states in this country, and we also have international participants from Canada, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So it's a bit of a global call with everybody on the call, and it's a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, today's program has been made possible by educational grants from Astellas and Medivation, Genomic Health, Inc., Janssen Services, LLC, and the Safeway Foundation. I really want to thank them for their support of the program today and also for their collaboration in making this program possible. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. And in those materials is information about our speakers and the topics they'll be addressing. And there also is information about all those different collaborating organizations as resources for you. They all have 800 numbers and websites, and those are wonderful resources for all of you. Now, there also is an evaluation form, and we very much appreciate your completing those forms and sending them back to us. When you think about it, you are the best people to tell us what our programs should look like, the topics we should offer, the focus of the programs so that they're most relevant to meet your specific needs. So please complete the evaluation forms and, most importantly, recommend topics that you'd like us to offer. Indeed, this three-part series is based on the recommendations that other participants have given us to organize a program on prostate cancer, a series like this. So we listen to you, and we're planning many new programs, so, of course, your feedback is very essential. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Susan Sloven, and she is a frequent presenter on our programs. And she is an attending physician of a genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She's professor of medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. It's really my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Sloven to the program today. And Dr. Sloven is going to address an overview of metastatic prostate cancer, current standard of care, and understanding new treatment approaches. I now turn the program over to Dr. Sloven.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for dialing in, and I hope I can be of some benefit to you today. We have limited time, so perhaps whatever we don't get to today, we can talk about perhaps in the question session, but as Dr. Messner says, we have some really great people on the call today, and I think they will be very helpful to you. I'm charged with, again, a very daunting topic, which is to talk about metastatic prostate cancer. So I'm bypassing newly diagnosed disease and will really be addressing what's out there from the time a person is diagnosed with disease that's gone beyond the confines of the prostate to other body parts such as bone, lymph nodes, and then for the change in the behavior of the cancer that leads to the disease becoming resistant to the standards of care. So for a patient who has developed, or at the time of diagnosis, has an elevated PSA and is accompanied by disease that can be seen on either a bone scan or CAT scan as being in the bone or lymph node, the standard of care is hormonal ablation. More recently, we are adopting other drugs to participate in hormonal ablation. The standards have always been to use an anti-androgen known as bicalutamide, for example, in concert with a GnRH analog, which is known as the hormone. It's not a woman's hormone, but it's a drug that interferes with the signal between the brain and the testis and stops the production of testosterone, the male hormone, which feeds the cancer. More recently, in an effort to really prevent a flare of testosterone that occurs when the communication between the brain and the testis is severed, we have been adapting another drug that's an injection that is an antagonist as opposed to an agonist, meaning it's a direct blocker of the production of testosterone from the brain to the testis. And it works very rapidly. And not that it's better than the conventional treatments we use, but it can be, it's just a new drug that is being introduced, widely accepted, and can cause castrate levels of testosterone very, very quickly. Again, FDA approved and has been around for at least the last 2 to 3 years. But in any event, if neither of the drugs work, this is manifested as a elevation in PSA. Disease itself on scans could remain stable or be worse. And very often we term the condition as being castration resistant, meaning that despite of achieving very, very low levels of testosterone, the PSA and or the disease has returned on imaging. But that does not mean that this is a treatment failure. It means that other drugs, other antiandrogens, drugs that block the androgen receptor, which is the site to which testosterone has bound itself previously, is sort of overactive, and what we need to do is try to have other agents that interfere with it. So second, third line agents are doable among the antiandrogens. We're very fortunate to have some new drugs that are out there now, one being enzalutamide, the other name for it is Xtandi, X-T-A-N-D-I, which is very specific to the androgen receptor. Zytiga, or abiraterone, is also approved in this setting as a second or even a third line agent prior to chemo or even after chemo, because it works at a completely different site, which is called the adrenal gland. And again, it works at many, many precursor pathways well before the production of testosterone. So even though one is deemed as being resistant to current therapy, there still are other second, third, fourth line antiandrogens or androgen receptor blockers that can work very effectively. As part of the standard of care for patients who have failed second or third line agents, there are immunologic approaches, for example, Cipolusil-T by Provenge or the Dendreon Company, which is a immune product. It's not really vaccine by virtue of what we think of as being vaccine as a preventive agent, but it's a manipulation of some of the white cells in the body to make the white cells very educated in recognizing offending agents within the bloodstream, that is, i.e., the cancer. And this has been shown to, this has been approved for patients who have no evidence of symptoms but have disease that has failed conventional hormonal therapy. In addition to Provenge, there have been other drugs that are looking very exciting. Chemotherapy has been around for a very long time. Most people are very worried about chemotherapy. They associate it with side effects that were they used to see in their grandparents years ago. But I'm very pleased to say that the side effect profile for chemotherapy is much improved. We have patients who go to work right after chemotherapy, and it is not necessarily a drug that's associated with somebody who has no other recourse. I personally use chemotherapy for patients whose disease becomes very rapidly progressive, or if their patient's PSA is doubling or tripling so quickly I can't get a good handle on it, or if someone has such significant pain that I would have to radiate many, many different sites and perhaps affect their marrow, then we give chemotherapy, and chemotherapy has been known to spare the bone marrow and provide less toxicity, but also give pain control and improve quality of life. So the standard chemotherapy has been docetaxel, otherwise known as Taxotere, and we're also very fortunate for those patients who are either poorly responding to docetaxel or have responded to it but have then failed subsequently, called cabazitaxel. And this is another drug in the, what we call taxane family or microtubular inhibitor family, that has also been shown to be extremely beneficial for some patients who have failed standard chemotherapy. As always, for patients who have failed treatment, whether it's hormonal manipulation or chemotherapy, we always want to make sure that we can affect the biology of the cancer, perhaps earlier in the disease course, and maybe delay the time that we go on to some of the newer agents that are out there or even chemotherapy. And we do that by virtue of clinical trials. Clinical trials are innovative ways of giving drugs that have been around for a long time or combining them with novel biologic agents in an effort to really change the biology of the cancer. So the philosophy of if you fail one treatment, you go on to the next, all standards of care does not necessarily prevail. Our own institution, which I'm sure many people know, have been leaders in clinical trials where we look at new agents or look at novel ways of giving drugs or combinations of drugs to see if we can forestall other treatments and really affect the patient's biology such that other treatments that they will eventually come to use may be perhaps more effective. So it's always very beneficial to think of a clinical trial. There are other drugs that we use in concert with the standards that are out there to keep the bone nice and strong. One is called Zometa or zoledronic acid that has been FDA approved for several years and is known to improve the integrity of the bone and to delay time to skeletal events, meaning cord compression or fractures within the bone. Another one called Xgeva, X-G-E-V-A, or denosumab is also FDA approved and is also for bone strengthening. One of the major questions that often comes across my visits with patients is, are there other ways of determining how aggressive my cancer is at the get-go, I mean at the time of diagnosis, or can you assess what my cancer is going to do later on if it fails X, Y, and Z? Well, we're in a very exciting time in the sense that we now have molecular imaging where we can use specific probes to see how the cancer behaves on different kinds of imaging modalities such as PET scans or even bone scans. But perhaps more exciting is, while not yet ready for prime time, there are molecular markers that are being evaluated to see whether or not genetic mutations have occurred within the tumor that would explain the change in the tumor's biology. Now, they are not ready for prime time. They are being evaluated, but they're really not validated sufficiently enough to really say that a change in a particular gene or a mutation or change in a gene can lead to a change in the patient's biology. Many of you may have heard of a recent tool that's out there called Prolaris, which is being used very early on to predict whether or not patients will do well with their prostate cancer, and it's based on some gene signatures. Again, this is a means of evaluating the prognosis of the cancer from its inception, but it still alone is just not the only thing one would use in determining how the cancer will behave. Clearly, the level of aggressiveness of the cancer, the pretreatment PSA, and you know the tumor volume is very, very important. I know I've spoken a great deal about all these things, and it's just not enough to really really give fair balance to everything that's out there now, but I think the takeaway point is that we are so far ahead of the game now, more than ever before, and it's really become an exciting time. So, Carolyn, back to you and our next speakers. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Slovin, for just a really expert presentation, very comprehensive and very informative, really covering a great deal in such a brief amount of time. So thank you. I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Natalie Morell, and Dr. Morell is Assistant Attending Physician, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Pain and Palliative Care Service, Department of Medicine, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Morell is going to address dealing with treatment side effects, pain management, and quality of life concerns. Dr. Morell?
About this subject today, and I'm going to start with side effects of treatment. So symptoms and treatment-related side effects can be seen at any stage of prostate cancer. In a study evaluating treatment side effects and quality of life of men with prostate cancer during the first 3 months after diagnosis of metastatic prostate cancer, the quality of life didn't really change that much. At the longest study of 8 months, of when 400 men were asked about their symptoms, they mostly really complained of fatigue and emotional distress. And with time and on hormonal ablation treatment, side effects of treatment may start to change. Androgen deficiency resulting from hormonal treatment is a constellation of symptoms related to lack of androgen, and it could include hot flashes, night sweats, as well as osteoporosis, decrease in muscle mass, fatigue, and depressed mood. Prostate cancer treatment can also be associated with weight gain, increased risk of diabetes, and high risk of high blood pressure. I'm going to start with hot flashes and night sweats. They're actually pretty prevalent. They're commonly reported. Up to 60 to 80% of patients report these symptoms, and they can persist long term. And in fact, 50% of men experience them at 5 years and up to 8 years after the initiation of hormonal treatment. Night sweats can disturb sleep patterns and lead to patients feeling tired and irritable. And the most important thing to remember about these are is that there are medications that could be used to treat them. And there are a few treatment options, such as antidepressant medications that treat hot flashes related to different medical conditions, including treatment complication for prostate cancer. Also drugs such as gabapentin and pregabalin, also known as Neurontin and Lyrica, that are used to treat a variety of neurological disorders, can be quite effective in controlling hot flashes. Alternative medicine can also be used, such as acupuncture, that is reported to be extremely effective. However, it obviously takes longer and it's more costly. A significant but silent side effect of prostate cancer treatment is osteoporosis. Given the clinical significance of osteoporotic fractures in men, as well as the risk of bone metastases-related events, it's routinely screened for and it's treated. You just need to be aware of the risk of osteoporosis in addition to bone metastases and ready to receive treatment for it. It's extremely important to be compliant with the medications prescribed, even if it's something as simple as calcium and vitamin D, as well as other medications that will be prescribed to you by your oncologist. Because the risk of fracture, if you ignore osteoporosis, can be, you know, up to 20% in 10 years. So it's really it's a separate complication of treatment that needs to be addressed and monitored carefully. And that is it's incorporated in guidelines of most prostate cancer treatments. You just need to be aware of it. And also, lifestyle modifications would be very helpful, such as stop smoking and not more than moderate alcohol intake, and maintain your active lifestyle, weight-bearing exercises. In addition to osteoporosis, patients with prostate cancer may also encounter sarcopenia, or loss of muscle mass and strength, that normally occurs with aging, but also could be accelerated by hormonal treatment. And it's blamed for impaired functional performance, increased physical disability, and increased risk for falls, especially in elder men. So again, exercises appear to be the best treatment to combat the muscle mass loss. The other very common symptom is depression, or sometimes called adjustment disorder. It's well known that as men age and testosterone levels decrease, the prevalence of depression increases. And it's not uncommon to see patients who are undergoing treatment for prostate cancer to report some anxiety, depression, or difficulty adjusting to the new physical health. At our cancer center, we have a designated psychiatrist who specializes in mood changes commonly associated with treatment of prostate cancer. And these could be very helpful, both the counseling and the pharmacological management. So again, I would just encourage you to please bring it up with your clinical team and have it addressed separately, because it will improve the quality of life and may improve also the outcomes. I'm going to move on to discussing pain management. Pain can occur at each stage of prostate cancer, and most commonly it is associated with cancer itself, sometimes treatment, and sometimes could be unrelated to cancer altogether, such as osteoarthritis. Pain is a signal that you need to report to your physician to see if it signifies any new injury and if the underlying cause should be treated separately. While the urologist will be the main treating physician for most of the patient's clinical course, in many cases, and certainly if treatment extends over a long period of time or disease progresses, you may need involvement of pain specialist or a multidisciplinary team that could coordinate the symptom management and help you with goals of care. Pain management involves mainly direct anti-cancer therapy that Dr. Slovin covered. In addition to that, we use analgesics, starting with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, something like Advil, Motrin, and other medications you just can't pick up over-the-counter in your pharmacy, as well as opioids. While over-the-counter painkillers can be helpful, they're also associated with side effects such as renal injury and stomach bleeding. So if you are to need chronic pain management, the risk and benefit ratio changes, and actually opioids, commonly called narcotics, may be safer long-term than something you can easily pick up in the pharmacy. Opioids include morphine, fentanyl, hydromorphone, methadone, the same drug as used in for treatment of drug addiction. All these drugs could improve the quality of life, and they're used very frequently in patients with prostate cancer. The main issue related to pain is the following. I would like to encourage you to report your pain and try to manage your pain in such a way that it would allow you to keep the most active lifestyle possible. Life expectancy for prostate cancer is greatly influenced by the patient's overall health, and being physically active, exercising regularly, will have a major impact on your quality of life, bone strength, muscle mass, your mood, and potentially can influence the outcome of your cancer treatment. If pain prevents you from staying active, please strongly consider taking stronger pain medications, obviously under the guidance of your doctors, and do the best to continue a healthy lifestyle. Again, it will also address the muscle mass and depression. If you receive opioids, please make sure you store medication safely away from children, pets, and strangers. But when used correctly, and it is very safe to take opioid medications long-term through survivorship. In case of local metastasis causing severe pain, primary treatments could include surgery, radiation therapy, kyphoplasty, nerve blocks, and other interventions. These would be recommended to you by your doctor, by oncologist or pain doctor. As far as quality of life is concerned, quality of life of men with prostate cancer has become an important topic in the literature with good reason. Prostate cancer is one of the most common cancers in the United States, and given its long natural history, patients live for many years after the diagnosis. Low quality of life at baseline can improve over time and can be helped with medications and active lifestyle. Thank you for the opportunity to give to discuss that issue with you, and I'm going to go back to Dr. Messner. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Morrell, for just a wonderful presentation, very informative, really, about the issues of really coping with treatment side effects and pain management and quality of life. Those are really very important issues, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Now, our next, we're going to bring back Dr. Slovin, and Dr. Slovin is going to address issues of radiation oncology, the role of radiation oncology, clinical trials, and communicating with the healthcare team. So I'm now going to turn this program over to Dr. Slovin again. Thank you, Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. Radiation itself is not harmful to a patient. And I think people, when they hear the word radiation, become very, very frightened. Radiation has been the standard of care for patients who are not deemed operable candidates when they have newly diagnosed prostate cancer. We use radiation for patients who, for example, while they're not being surgical candidates, may have fear of going through surgery, and we do radiation. Radiation comes in different forms, from seed implants or what we call interstitial seed implants or brachytherapy, proton beam therapy, external beam radiation therapy. These are all terms for types of radiation that we do in appropriate settings. We also do radiation for patients who have what we call high-risk disease, characterized by Gleason scores of 8, 9, 10, or PSAs greater than 20, or very, very big glands. Now, we call them high-risk because they're not at high risk for mortality. They're at high risk for disease that comes back, and therefore these are patients who would receive treatment with hormones, radiation, and some more hormones. But the benefit is that it's radiation. Radiation has comes in many forms, from external beams to seed implants and to what we call radiopharmaceuticals, to which I just alluded, such as drugs like samarium or Quadramet is the other name for it, and more recently another drug that has been shown to alleviate pain called alpharadin or Xofigo, X-O-F-I-G-O. These are two radiopharmaceuticals that have been shown to improve pain and can be ultimately used along with chemotherapy. So aside from radiation coming in different forms, if you will, one of its greatest roles is in that of pain palliation. You just heard Dr. Morrell make a very important point, which is if you have pain, take more pain medication. And this is just something that doesn't sit well with patients. The idea that you need more pain medication immediately projects this image that, oh my God, my cancer is worse, therefore it is a problem. And therefore, if that is the case, I may become addicted, and it leads to just all sorts of difficult problems. So what happens very often is patients are very unwilling to take additional pain medications, and I think many people think they're going to become addicted. They're not. You really have to have a very addicting personality in order to come under that auspices. But most of our patients who are on very high doses of narcotics are never addicted. I mean, we can wean them off and down and off on rare occasions, but they are not craving the drugs. So for those patients who just need more pain requirements, sometimes we can lessen them by giving radiation. Radiation can be given to areas in the bone that are causing pain. Radiation can be given in concert sometimes with other agents to maximize a biologic effect. But in general, it is extremely helpful. The toxicity can be a transient decline in the white blood cell count, but otherwise it's well tolerated. We have specialists. These are the radiation oncologists who really know how to give radiation. It involves a heck of a lot of physics and knowing toxicity and knowing where to put the radiation beams. And as such, these are people who really have wonderful expertise in knowing how to not only take care of a primary cancer, but also to take care of areas in the that have metastasized in bone that are really causing problems. We, of course, know that we don't want to radiate your whole body, but, of course, we can spare some of the areas by just giving chemotherapy, which in and of itself can control disease and make pain a little bit better. Clinical trials, I've alluded to those before. They are probably the only way that we know how to get drugs approved quickly, safely, and to the advantage of everyone. Probably the breast cancer patients have the best track record in getting drugs to market and approved very rapidly. Why? I think a lot of it is that women are very motivated, they're very aggressive, and the trials just get done so quickly. Again, to recapitulate what I had said earlier, clinical trials do one thing. They really address sometimes an unmet need in the cancer population. Patients who might not be able to take certain drugs can benefit from others. It provides a novel way of dosing or combinations. And again, it's to try to change the biology of the cancer, and that is what it is all about for any drugs that are out there right now. I think what is very, very important is how we all communicate together, because sometimes patients come in having had their radiation and I don't have a note from their radiation oncologist, or they've seen their primary care physician or their internist and I don't have notes, and each doctor is pointing to the other doctor saying, well, whoever didn't send me anything. I want to assure you that it is perfectly fine to tell a doctor or ask a doctor to please send a note to your other referring doctors. That's the way we would best communicate. There is nothing wrong with asking your doctor, could he or she perhaps pick up a phone and call up another doctor who is participating very strongly in this person's care, mainly because we want, you're the patient. We really want to do right by you. And this is not a matter of ego. And I really do take umbrage sometimes when somebody says, well, the doctor says you should call him because you didn't call him immediately. Ergo, you should call. This is not about ego. This has to do with the patient's safety, patient's well-being. And therefore, as far as I'm concerned, whatever it takes to make a patient safe and well, we just pick up a phone and call. But we should always list, and we should list, the names of your other doctors on our notes. Sometimes patients don't even know their doctor's names. They go to a doctor. They say, well, my doctor says I can come back in a year. Or my doctor changed my medication. He won't say anything else to me. That's not true. I don't believe that. I think that if there really is a communication problem, either you get a new doctor or ask your doctor to try to facilitate your understanding of what is going on. It's extremely important. The one thing I would encourage all patients to do is to please take a look at your medications, write them down, type them, keep them in your wallet or purse so that you do know what you're taking. So there's just too many pills, and we just don't know based on colors or designation. One's a hexagon, one's a square. It doesn't help. So this is just really a very brief reminder of what is going on in the world, that there are so many novel treatments for you, and there are a lot of people who do care. So I know this is very cursory, but back to you, Carolyn. Thank you.
Well, actually, very comprehensive, Dr. Slovin, and just really excellent about the whole issues of the different types of radiation treatments, as well as the importance of this doctor-patient communication. We'll probably say more about that as well during the Q&A, but that's so important. And so thank you for that wonderful presentation. And I can see questions are coming in already for you, so there'll be questions during the Q&A now. And our next speaker is William Gorin. William is an oncology social worker, director of clinical services at Cancer Care. And Mr. Gorin is going to address a review of the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to Mr. Gorin, who is both a colleague and friend of mine at Cancer Care. Mr. Gorin?
Thank you, Dr. Messner, Dr. Messner and Dr. Slovin and Morrell. I'm going to pick up where both doctors had spoken about in terms of the emotional psychological factors. Prostate cancer is comparatively the primary male-identified cancer where the emotional and psychological factors of the illness and the treatment side effects are justifiably as decisively important as are the medical and clinical factors, if not more. And unlike most other cancers, prostate cancer speaks really to the heart of male identity and image. So that the discussion of potential treatment side effects like loss of libido, lack or loss of a libido, impotence, incontinence, and as well as the other potential side effects mentioned by the other doctors are absolute components to be carefully and clearly reviewed by the medical team and necessitate ongoing exploration with the patient and the affected loved ones if that's possible. The variables of disease and treatment side effects place a man and his partner immediately in the midst of quality of life issues that render the potential for in-depth and heartfelt discussions focused on the makeup of the relationship, especially intimacy and love. There are two essential psychological considerations when reviewing the diagnosis of prostate cancer and treatment side effects. The first is the attitude of the patient and the loved one about the diagnosis and the treatments. And the second and equally important consideration is the capacity to communicate those concerns about the changes that often accompany the diagnosis and the treatment. Many men with prostate cancer, as well as their partners, seek out external support systems. That could be individual or couples counseling, group counseling for either the person with cancer or the caregiver, and also contacting peer support organizations. Because these outlets can all provide the couple with the information to improve coping strategies, as well as provide communication skills and tools, all necessary to build a framework that is about learning to live with prostate cancer. Cancer Care's oncology social workers are expert in supporting anyone affected by cancer, the person with cancer and the caregiver. Cancer Care's counseling services, whether that's in person or on the phone or online for our national clients, can provide the emotional support couples may need to begin their courageous journey of learning to live with prostate cancer. So to that end, I do want to mention and give thanks to the Safeway Foundation, who has provided us a grant to begin an online support group for men with prostate cancer. The online support group program is a password-protected and social work-facilitated online group that will run for 15 weeks starting at the beginning of June. This group provides a safe and confidential space where men can discuss the unique challenges of living with prostate cancer while giving and receiving support, information, and guidance with other men. To access this group and to find out more information or to register for the group, one must go to the Cancer Care website, which is www.cancercare.org/support groups, to learn about the group and to register for the group. So I really urge our listeners, those men with prostate cancer, if you're interested in an online support group, please check out our website. Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you, Dr. Slovin and Dr. Morrell.
Well, thank you very much, Bill, for just a wonderful presentation and really identifying many of the psychosocial issues that confront people living with metastatic prostate cancer, and also for all the services and the group that we'll be starting, which I'm sure we'll hear more about during the Q&A as well. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers, and now we do have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions, and I'm going to ask Stephanie to explain to you how to queue up for questions. If we don't get to your question, or you think of a question in the next couple of days or weeks, please don't hesitate to call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. I'll repeat that number at the end of the call. In the meantime, Stephanie, though, will take as many of your questions as possible. So Stephanie will explain to you how to queue up for questions both online and also on the telephone.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Allison S. Your line is open.
Yes, no one mentioned the drug Casodex. Can you tell me something about that drug?
Oh, excellent question. Dr. Slovin, would you address that?
I actually did mention Casodex. The other name for Casodex is bicalutamide. So Casodex and or bicalutamide is the same drug. It is an anti-androgen, which means that it blocks the ability of testosterone in your bloodstream from binding to the tumor cell at a particular site known as the androgen receptor. And what happens is Casodex or bicalutamide gets in there first and blocks testosterone. We often use it in concert with the hormone Lupron, for what we call combined blockade. It was originally designed to prevent the sudden outpouring of testosterone that occurs once you sever the connection between the brain and the testes. Remember, the testes still wait to hear from the brain as to whether or not there should be more production or of testosterone. So when it doesn't hear anything, it makes more testosterone. And if you happen to have the misfortune of having a very large prostate that could be obstructing or having significant bone disease, that sudden outpouring of testosterone can actually cause worsening pain. So Castex was developed as a means to prevent that quote-unquote flare that has more testosterone and blocks the its ability to bind to the tumor cells. There are other anti-androgens in use. They go by different names. There's Ulexin, which is known as flutamide. There's Nylandron or nilutamide. They're all in the same family. And then more recently, we have enzalutamide, whose mechanism of action is similar to but a little bit more defined. And then there is, of course, abiraterone or Zytiga that works through a completely different mechanism, but the goal is the same. I hope that answered your question.
Well, thank you. Very comprehensive. And we have a question from one of our online participants. How can the doctor differentiate low back pain with sciatic pain caused by metastatic cancer versus muscle tension in the low back? Dr. Slovin, can you address that, and also Dr. Morrell, just in a general way?
I think we can do a little tandem on this one. It's interesting because I just saw a patient who is constantly taking his pain medication, and I asked him, I said, is it really pain, or are you feeling stiffness or musculoskeletal pain? And it's very, very hard, and I know Dr. Morrell can probably do a little bit better on this, but from my perspective, pain that is migratory, for example, is likely not to be cancer pain, and I can tell you that this very humid weather seems to bring out a heck of a lot more aches and pains than ever. But cancer pain is usually unremitting in a very limited, if not focused, area, and it can be very, very dull or achy, and it's just there, it won't leave. Migratory pain, you know, stiffness usually gets better with activity or a hot shower. The stiffness is usually due to degenerative or osteoarthritis, and you know, if you sit at a desk for long hours and suddenly get up and you're stooped, somehow just a little bit of movement for the next 5 or 10 minutes actually makes things a lot better for you. So, you know, sometimes the non-steroidals, such as Advil or Aleve, can actually make non-cancer-related pain a lot better. But on the other hand, for some bone lesions or other areas of, you know, due to cancer metastasis, sometimes it can be very helpful. Dr. Moreau, would you like to add to that, please?
Sure. So arthritis pain would be associated, again, with stiffness. It would actually decrease during the day. When people wake up, it hurts more to move during the day as they become more active. The pain subsides usually after stretching and exercising and just moving more. Metastatic bone pain usually gets worse as the day progresses. It's usually reproducible and usually is associated with sites of known metastases, which could be seen on bone scan, MRI, or CAT scan. But I would recommend to ask that question, to discuss it with your oncologist, because this, based on the details of complaints and the physical exam, it's usually pretty clear which one contributes to pain more, where sometimes it's a combination of both. So it's there very typical clinical symptoms associated with both of them, and it's not difficult usually on the clinical exam and after the interview with the patient to understand which one causes pain.
Oh, excellent. Thank you very much. And actually, I wonder if Bill wanted to just comment in terms of our groups and people's discussions and concerns about pain and thinking that any pain is connected to cancer. I want to comment on that.
Sure. That pain and associated side effects to treatment and are really vital components of the discussions that men have, having done both online and face-to-face groups here at Cancer Care. I can say that these discussions are part and parcel, and really the substantive focus of the discussions that men have with each other in terms of really trying to figure out and determine how to improve or even just maintain quality of life while going through and experiencing a life-sustaining treatment. These reactions, loss of virility, incontinence, these potential side effects for many men result in a sort of a composite or amalgam of many different reactions: confusion, fear, anxiety, sadness, anger, shame, and pain certainly seems to exacerbate all of these. So for men to be able to discuss this and open up and really share all of these side effects and reactions, these emotional side effects and reactions, are really provide them with a sense of identity and understanding and knowing that they're not alone in going through this. As important as and essential in terms of support as it is to be with a professional, whether that's a medical professional or some mental health professional, sometimes being with other people, other men who are in the same situation and are going through the same experience you are going through, really can really provide an opening and a chance to feel less isolated and less alone in the journey in learning to live with cancer.
Thank you so much. Excellent. And so we do very much recommend certainly that, John, you consult with your healthcare team and also consult and think of getting also some support as well with dealing with cancer. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Dottie K. Your line is open.
Hi, I have a question. As a spouse of a prostate victim, we know how bad the side effects are of hormone deprivation, especially for young men who have to look forward to this the rest of their life. Why aren't we using more immunotherapy like Provenge or Ipilimumab, even in trial forms before they become castration resistant to try to decrease some of those side effects?
It's a very complicated answer. First of all, we do not have sufficient data available that immune therapy given very early on is going to have any impact on the cancer. We think it should. There have been many phase one and phase two trials, but the problem is for patients who are newly diagnosed, the standards of care have been to take out the prostate or to do radiation. The use of immunotherapy does not necessarily curtail hormones, but still, from a biologic and a physiologic effect, the thought is that that hormonal therapy can be very advantageous depending on the stage of the disease. We normally do not give hormonal therapy when someone is newly diagnosed unless they have very high-risk disease and are going for radiation. If somebody has localized disease, we often recommend either some form of radiation or active surveillance or a prostatectomy. One of the issues, ipilimumab has been evaluated in phase 1 and phase 2, and there are two phase 3 trials that are, I believe, accrued, but we don't have the data yet. It is not a lightweight therapy. It has efficacy in melanoma, but it does have some side effects that have to be taken under advisement. Provenge is a cellular product immunotherapy. It is not a preventive vaccine. As you know, it has certain benefits, but its overall impact on perhaps micrometastatic disease may be very different than somebody who has disease that you can see on a scan. The real answer to your question, with all stops barred, is that the FDA mandates that many of these therapies, probably 98% of the therapies that are out there, must show some form of efficacy, including survival benefit, before it can be moved earlier on into the arena of treatment. There are investigational trials looking at immune modulatory agents in the phase 1 setting. The issue is whether or not the patient is going to be a relevant candidate, and that's really the other thing that we have to deal with. So we have two problems. One is the FDA, and number two, it's not for all comers, unfortunately.
something. And Dottie, actually, I certainly would like to call you after the call, and I know that Bill would like to probably add to this discussion in terms of young adults, a young person diagnosed with cancer, and some of the emotional and social issues that both you and your husband are coping with, and some of the supports that are out there to help you. Bill, would you like to comment here?
Absolutely, and I appreciate you calling on behalf of your husband, and I think especially for young adults, these are really very powerful and important issues in terms of determining and figuring out how to cope with it and live with this disease, especially in light of beginning beginning a relationship or planning for future or planning for family, and all of this should be discussed in depth, and I your question is such an important question, and it really speaks to the communication between the man with prostate cancer and the loved one, the spouse, the partner, to really be able to determine how do we figure this out, how do we determine this, and I think whether it's with the oncologist or whether that's with a mental health specialist or with a fertility specialist in terms of figuring out how do we preserve quality of life and what does quality of life mean to us in terms of our future together, in terms of planning for a family, all of these levels of quality of life issues really need to be determined and really discussed on a very ongoing basis. This is not a one-time discussion, but really need to be visited and revisited as treatment progresses and one learns to begin to cope with this diagnosis. So I urge our callers to reach out to their oncologist to find out what a comprehensive services in terms of mental health assistance, whether it's through psychiatry, psychology, social worker, to really improve and bolster that support structure, because this is essential. I mean, support on all levels is really essential to beginning to live with prostate cancer.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you very much. And I have to say, this has been an extraordinary call. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've really just been amazing. I want to thank all of you who've asked really such excellent questions, and very personal questions, very thoughtful questions. And I want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour program, and that planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have so many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so I want to remind all of you that although the program will soon end, the services that you can access, and these services are free from Cancer Care, those are endless. And I just want to review them with you. We have a staff of many oncology social workers here who provide all types of help. We are available to talk with you, to provide counseling services, to listen to your concerns, and to help you figure out what you want to do with those concerns. We also offer support groups, both on the telephone and online, so a chance to talk with other people who are coping with metastatic prostate cancer, other types of cancers. We offer those groups as well, and we have a group right now that we're actually recruiting for that Bill had mentioned. And we also offer practical and financial assistance. We have, of course, these workshops. And indeed, I want to just mention that our next workshop in this series, part three of this series, actually is taking place on June 11th. It's on a Tuesday, and it's for caregivers coping with a loved one's metastatic prostate cancer. And that's for caregivers, so I know there are caregivers on the call, and it's open to anyone to participate in, but there will be a bit of a focus for caregivers' issues as well. We also have materials and publications that we offer as well. And so we kind of have a bit of everything for everyone, and we would definitely recommend that you take advantage of these services. Give us a call. We're here to help you. Again, I want to thank you all for participating and remind all of you that you can call us at 1-800-813-4673 and speak with one of our social workers at any time. Thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.